We're taking up again the secret doctrine. Always, I think, an exciting study and one that leads us into depths that where we can become, yes, very confused. And I am really attempting only to share with you as my own understanding grows of these various magnificent concepts that have been presented to us. I will recall to your minds that we have begun the series on anthropogenesis, that is, volume 2 in the two volumes, the second volume of the two volumes of the Secret Doctrine, that is, the two volumes of the original edition, which is the one to which I am referring in the pagination. And if you have the six-volume edition, there are concordances which are very simple to follow. And as customary, therefore, at the first session, and this term we have five sessions together, we will do a bit of reviewing, not a complete review, of course, but a bit of review, and principally, I think we have to discover where we are, because the whole thrust of this second volume of anthropogenesis, and one can even start with this. In fact, Jeffrey Barborka, who was indeed, as many of you know, one of the finest students on the secret doctrine that the society had, felt that really, in many ways, one should start with an understanding of the human evolution, the human development. I have taken another point of view, which I think is equally valid, and that is that it's helpful to start with the cosmogonic processes, the principles underlying the whole evolution of a system, the whole bringing into manifestation of a cosmos, which is dealt with in Volume 1. But we are now considering the whole evolutionary development that has brought us to our present position and that has brought our home, this planet, to its present position, which is not its ultimate condition, nor are we yet finished. As I've said, I think, on previous occasions, we are really indeed only half-baked. And the baking process will continue, and I think it's a good term, a good analogy, a good metaphor, because very often we do find ourselves either in hot water or feel that we're being toasted in ovens of extreme heat through the experiences that we endure. So perhaps that is not a bad metaphor to use at all. So, as I say, before we resume the story as it unfolds in the shlokas of Volume 2, and incidentally, for those of you who may not be at all familiar with the fundamental bases on which HPB hung, if I can put it that way, her commentaries, her exposition of the esoteric philosophy, in these very ancient stanzas known as the stanzas of Dian, we really haven't time to review all of that. But within the secret doctrine itself, in Volume 1, in the introductory sections, and particularly in the definitive edition of the two volumes set in the introductory work by Boris de Zirkov, one has a complete understanding presented of what these ancient stanzas are. In one sense, the source of them and the basis of them is irrelevant to the progression that is given of the esoteric philosophy itself. These are useful and they are valuable, and I don't mean to say they are not valuable, but to probe into their historicity is irrelevant from the point of view of the principles which underlie the esoteric philosophy itself. So before resuming our study, in terms of the srokas of these stanzas, which comprise volume 2, I think it's useful to seat ourselves in the universe. We are a very intimate part of the system, a very intimate part. Our very fabric, our physical fabric, is not different from, nor distinct from, the physical fabric of the planet we occupy. And I think, therefore, we have to see ourselves as seated in and one with the universe. Now, this is not an easy task, but certain principles, essential principles, do emerge which help us very much to see where we are. To me, this also gives a very valid answer to the question so often asked, why is the study of the secret doctrine relevant, or is it at all relevant today? Is it going to help me live any differently? Well, yes and no. I mean, it depends on what you mean by living. If it means going down to Safeway and getting milk periodically, it really doesn't matter, therefore, whether we came from the moon chain or where we originated, you know. The incarnation of the Manasaputras and all of these things, you see. I mean, after all, one can get to Safeway and back without knowing that you are, in effect, a Manasaputra inhabiting a seven-principled vehicle, entity. But on the other hand, I think that by seeing where we belong, where we are seated in our system, we gain a perspective which does give a deeper and more profound meaning to life itself, to every existence. And we see that, to me, it makes us become perhaps a little less anxious. You know, whether earthquakes occur in San Francisco, as they have in the last few days, or come to us here in Southern California, you know, the whole system has a future, and I think this is what is helpful. So what I propose to review today, first of all, is something of the teaching in regard to where we are, where we stand, and this involves a tremendous concept known as the planetary chains. But underlying that, and indeed underlying the entire progression which is presented to us of human development, is a fundamental principle of the esoteric philosophy. HPB puts it very simply in the first volume that everything in the metaphysical as in the physical universe is septenary. Everything. This is fundamental to the esoteric philosophy. The principle of the septenates. And one can become very, very tired, I suppose, after a while of sevens of this and seven of that and so on and sub-sevens and all the rest of it, but that is a very, very clear principle. Now, this concept, then, of the planetary chains is not at all an easy concept to grasp in all of its ramifications, and we have to remember that quite a bit of it has never been given to us, that it's fragmentary at best. HPB tells us very clearly that in her presentation of even the fundamental principles concerning this development of a system in which we are seated, that she omitted 11 stanzas of this great ancient manuscript, one of which, she says, gave a full description of the formation of planetary chains one after another. So, obviously, we are presented with only fragmentary information. And therefore, many of the details do elude us, and paradoxes arise. And as I frequently have said in previous classes, and you probably, some of you have heard it ad nauseum, but you're going to hear it again, one has to become accustomed in the study of the secret doctrine to the language of metaphor and paradox. And we're not always comfortable. You know, we want something to be what it is, and don't tell me it's something else. You know, this sort of thing. You just now said it's this way, and now you're telling me it's that way. Well, both are equally true, because language by its very nature is delimiting, and by saying one word, one has not said another, and yet the other word might be equally valid. So we have to live with it. Now, what we have to follow then very, very closely, as HPB herself has said on numerous occasions, is the law of analogy. Remembering that this law does not mean an exact correspondence. Analogy is a partial similarity on which comparisons can be based. And sometimes we want to make it be A equals B, rather than that A is similar to B, has certain characteristics, so that we may compare A with B. And this is what is meant by analogy. So we have to be cautious in this. We must not confuse, for example, the so-called planes of nature, that is, the fields in which evolution occurs, with the principles of the human constitution. There is an analogy, a similarity, and there are characteristics which are in common, but we must not confuse categories. This is one principle to keep very clearly in mind. There is an analogy, in other words, between the fields in which the evolutionary process takes place and the principles of the human constitution, but they are not the same, completely the same in substance. In the same way, we must not confuse the human principles with the spheres of a planetary chain, although again there is a similarity on which a comparison can be based. Now, this will also hold true when we come to speak of the great evolutionary stages through which our humanity has passed and is passing and will pass in the course of our present stay on Earth. So, as I say, underlying this entire subject is this basic principle, the principle of the septenates, as I call it. It's not stated that way, but it's HPB points out, and indeed, other esoteric expressions of the philosophy have pointed out a sevenfold basis. Now, before you immediately come up with, well, what about the Pythagorean decad? That is part of the septenate and fits in beautifully, because ultimately 10 becomes the perfect number reducible to 1. Won't go into that. It is also perfectly compatible with the astrological 12-fold system. So don't worry, these are all compatible, and they ultimately reduce to the septenate. So let's begin then with a very, very simple statement, summary, which I have put here. Our system, now I've put our in quote marks, because one of the things that we should review, and we may next week if it seems essential, is the fact that this particular system appears to be, and I can only say appears to be, on the basis of the evidence that is given us in the archaic records and that is given to us in some of the oldest scriptural texts, the Rig Veda, for example, as well as later texts such as the Upanishads, as well as in other systems, including the Chinese, the Chaldean, the Babylonian, the Egyptian, as well as the Greek, and so on, appear to emphasize that this particular totality of manifestation has as its aim, to put it very simply, and perhaps oversimplifying, has as its aim the development of, production of, self-consciousness. That is to say, reflective consciousness, which for us constitutes the goal of our humanity. Sometimes the question has been raised, and I think, in fact, John raised it recently, but the question has been raised, don't we begin to perceive everything from a kind of egocentric or anthropocentric point of view? Now this, for our system, appears to be indeed the perspective that is to be achieved. What was true for other systems, we do not know. Or for future systems, we have not been told. I think it's enough to grapple with our own system and not worry about past and future systems. Within our system, then, with this goal, which I've oversimplified, admittedly, in mind, we are told there are 7 planetary chains or rings. Now, if you look at the pages which I have given to you, you will see this in Figure 1, the 7 chains of the Earth scheme. Anyone didn't get a copy of this? Matty has them there. And this very easily shows you that there are 7 chains in this particular scheme. There was a previous scheme and there will be future schemes. And as the secret doctrine states, the entire process is one which has an inconceivable beginning and unimaginable end. In other words, no beginning and end. These are cyclic recurrences. So I can't tell you what previous schemes. I think we've got enough, as I say, to grapple with this. So if you want to delve into previous schemes and visualize future schemes, go ahead, that's your privilege, but I don't intend to do that. So you will note, however, that each of these chains, each one set of these 7 planetary chains, and they're numbered there, has within it 7 globes, generally arranged in this manner, A, B, C, D, E, F, G. Generally arranged in that manner. With D, the 4th, always standing alone. The fourth of any sequence is indeed an orphan. And in one of the great letters from Mr. Sinnott's and HPB's adept teachers, we read of orphan humanity. And this is indeed a point at which, within that, as we'll see in a moment, within that, we were left on our own. We now have to further the scheme. Up to this point, everything has been given to us. Now we put it together and we further the scheme. So seven globes. In four different levels of consciousness. Now we'll come to this in a minute. Four levels of consciousness, therefore. And in one sense, I've tried to indicate it, there is a difference in the fact that on the ascending arc, this being descending, ascending, A to D, a descending arc, D to G, an ascending arc, that these spheres, localized spheres of consciousness, through which particular kinds of consciousness will be developed, are slightly above, if we can put it that way. They are not equal to, A and G are not exactly equal, but they may be in the same realm, but of another kind of consciousness, if we can put it that way. So that there is an ascent, and therefore we are now going to focus eventually. Now, we have to keep in mind that in some of the early literature, this term chain was sometimes called ring. Sometimes this whole series of seven globes or spheres, however you want to call it, were called strings. Rather interesting, because in physics today there's now a new concept coming up, you know, known as the string concept. So maybe this goes back and we should have kept that word. I don't know. I'm not going to get into that. Now we have to remember in this regard, very, very clearly, a statement which is made in the Mahatma letters, that is, in terms of questions which were asked by Mr. Sinnott and Mr. Hume to the adept teachers, who were also HPB's teachers. Mistakes arising from confusion of terms that I had to learn from you, says the Mahatma to Mr. Sinnott. He had to learn from Mr. Sinnott, since it is you, that is Mr. Sinnott, who are the author of rounds, rings, etc. Now this is page 181 of the second edition of the Mahatma Letters. And in another place, which I don't have exactly before me, the statement is very clearly made that many of our terms are untranslatable. We have to recall that so far as a presentation of the esoteric philosophy was concerned, this was the first time it was in the vernacular, in the Vulgate, if you like, the contemporary Vulgate of English. And therefore, terms which were very familiar in the languages of the East, even in Greek, we found last week in listening to Geddes McGregor in discussing the Bible, the variety of translations from the Greek, from the Hebrew. Certainly this was true from the Sanskrit, from the Tibetan, from any of the mystery early mystery languages, the translations are always inadequate. And these are terms, then, which were really given by Mr. Sinnett, and then whose work was among the first, and preceded, of course, the secret doctrine itself. So these are not perhaps really accurate translations. And so we have to go behind this, because of our ignorance of the background of knowledge, for example, that lies behind many of the statements in the secret doctrine, and also of our very real Western tendency to literalism and separative thinking, the globes of a chain have, of course, come to be regarded as separate, independent entities circling the sun in different orbits and each apparently on one plane only. And so we have, and that's why I've made those lines, what shall I say, dashes, not solid lines. Because while it serves as a useful introduction to a very complicated subject, it is really quite incomplete to see these as completely separate and independent and operative on one level only. You see, it's like sort of taking ourselves apart, or rather like the doctor. I don't think any of us would go to a doctor who had only studied a course in anatomy. And that was the end. And he felt by the time he'd finished a course in anatomy, he knew all about medicine. We would hesitate, wouldn't we? Because we agree that all of us are certainly much more than our anatomical makeup, our anatomical structure, do we not? And when we go to see a doctor, we take the whole of us there, so to speak, including our moods and thoughts and opinions and prejudices and aspirations and frustrations and everything else. We take it all with us into the doctor's office, don't we? And yet, what walks into the doctor's office is an anatomical structure, as it were, of a physical body. So one has to see that in the same way, these are not so separate and independent and operative on one level only. Now that's not easy, is it? But for purposes of introduction, it's helpful to see it this way. So, in introducing to Western students, and remember that this was the presentation mainly for Western students, the subject of a group of interpenetrating globes, of which the Earth is one, the simplest method was adopted. Just as in medical school, one goes to courses that deal with the skeletal structure, the circulatory system, nervous system, etc., 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 doesn't one? And then you put them together, hopefully, and you understand the whole operation of the human body. So little more was given at the outset than the naming of the four levels or planes occupied by the seven chains of the Earth's scheme and the sweep of the life wave around them. Now, that sweep, then, is known as a round. That is to say, as one sweeps down and up, that is one round. And there are seven rounds to be undertaken on each of these chains. Seven rounds on seven globes. You've got to go around seven times. It's a bit of a merry-go-round, I admit. But, and in between each of these, as you will note on the diagram, figure 1 on the sheet I have given you, There is a large circle which is an interplanetary, interchain pralaya, a period of rest. So it's rather nice to know that as you have gone finish this seven times around, let us say, number four, which is the Earth there, which the Earth is the densest, you're going to get a little bit of rest. You'll need it, yes, by that time. We'll all need it, you see. So those larger circles there represent interchain pralayas. Now, happily, we also get bits of rest in between, also within the chain. Because within each of these globes, each time you have come on a round, each time you hit a globe, as it were, a sphere of consciousness, you're going to go through seven stages of the development of consciousness. Seven stages which have been given the term root race. And you'll see that every time I put it in quotation marks, simply to remind you, as we must always be reminded, that we are not talking of ethnic groups. We must not fall into that trap that we're racist in some manner. So we're going to go around each of these globes, seven in each globe, through seven developmental stages. And incidentally, that's what I want to focus on in the final four in this series this month, are the developmental stages, as we'll see in just a moment, in which we are now involved. So on each of these, now within each of these there are sub-stages, and within each of those we are told there are innumerable branchlets. So let's not worry about all the branchlets. So seven sub-races is one root race. Now, once one has finished one of those cycles within the globe, within one of those seven, there are periods of obscuration, as it's called. And so there is a kind of obscuration period before going on to the next globe with its seven, you see. So within that, there are periods of obscuration, as they're called.
Is the obscuration the same as the interchain
pralaya? I'm told it's different, according to HPB. I mean, I haven't really experienced it recently. But there seems to be a difference between obscuration of a particular globe within the chain and between chains, you see. So interchain is a bit different from the period here before going on to E, for example.
In other words, the obscuration relates only to the globe itself.
Yes, so that globe. And then between this whole chain and the next, as on that diagram, there is an interchain pralaya. But between D and E, and E and F, and so on, we could have circles there. If you want to put circles within circles, it's fine. But the diagram didn't permit of that. I've taken this diagram, as you'll see on page 2 of the papers I've given you, from the very interesting work by E.L. Gardner, Whence Come the Gods. I think the pamphlet may be out of print. Yes, Zella tells me it's out of print, and that's why I took these diagrams from it, because I think they are very helpful.
Well, I've got a question.
Yeah.
So if you look at D,
mm-hmm.
So there are at the physical level.
Yes.
So there are seven planets floating around D, and we have to go.
There are six others. There are six others.
Six others.
Yes.
So we go to each of those,
yes.
And that constitutes the
That's
round.
A full round. But meanwhile, we will have had seven stages on this. And before we move on to E, there is an obscuration period of D. D is an obscuration.
The obscuration period, is there any consciousness involved in that? Or
probably there is a kind of
sleep,
yes. So there may be, and with some entities, some of the more advanced entities, there may well be a deep awareness. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what's the
difference
with Ice Age in connection with the
Ice Age?
Ice Age.
Yes, well, that's within some of the sub and root races, because geological changes, and this is where there is a close correspondence, and this we have to keep in mind, and we'll come to it, but I'll bring it in here, and I'll probably repeat it. There is a very close correspondence between the condition of the planet we occupy at any particular time and the condition in which we are at any particular time. And consequently, the great cataclysms of the past, for example, the story of the flood and so on, relate to not only the turbulence on the planet and the breaking up of the continental land masses and the periods of ice ages followed by melting and retreat and the so on, which all has to do with the geological changes of the planet, are very closely, by analogy again, related to the developmental stages of humanity. Marvelous. So the planet during the first three rounds, for example, was not in the condition that it is in today, and presumably this is its most stable, and it's more and more difficult to break it up through this period. Consequently, the cataclysms are indeed violent, of volcanic eruptions, earthquakes, and so on, much more violent in terms of the physical impact than they were, for example, the geological stages during earlier rounds when the Earth was not quite as solid and not quite as, it was much easier to sort of pull it apart. It was more like taffy to sort of pull it apart.
The Maya said the list of the seven rounds that we have are in now is what restored to humanity at each
one. Yes.
Right. In the beginning, for instance, when you say about the darkness or the obscuration, there was darkness, complete darkness.
Yes.
Can that relate to that consciousness?
Oh yes, yes, indeed. Indeed. And then comes the glimmering of light and the awakening.
Mm. Yeah, and then it was fire and got destroyed by that.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was storm and destroyed by that. And then on the fourth time was the flood.
Mm-hmm.
And the next one is supposed to be earthquake.
Yes. This is, you see, fits in very well with the the whole esoteric tradition. Well, of course, the Mayas were a part of the esoteric tradition, of course. And it's rather interesting to see this alternation of fire and water, for example, which are the two elements that are most involved in our particular present life cycle. Now that may not be true for future or for past life cycles. Now with that in mind, just before we... Or did someone else have... with that in mind, let us now then focus on globe D, which I've now put in red, which is our Earth, where we are now. We have been here, or that is to say, the consciousness which is now expressing itself in us has been here, and the consciousness with which we're dealing, has been here three times before.
Now that's something. In other words,
come back here to the rounds. We have one, two, and three. We're now back here in the middle of the fourth time around. So we have three rounds behind us. In fact, I should really put three and a half rounds behind. Yes, three and a half rounds are behind us. Isn't that nice to know? You've got that behind you, you see, the monads. We are now in the fourth. We're here for the fourth time. Now remember the principle of four. This is the critical turning point. So we're here on the fourth round, which is an extremely critical turning point. And I'm sure that I don't need to convince anyone here that we are in critical times. We're as low as we can get. There's no place to go but up. And that is helpful to know. However difficult it seems, however dark it seems, this is as far down as we can go. So,
is this a guarantee against a nuclear war?
No, not at all. Not at all. There are no guarantees given to us. Isn't that something?
If we make the wrong choice.
You see, we are now, because the fourth is critical, because it is the moment of choice. It's a turning point. But what is more, we've also gone through four developmental stages or root races. So we're a little bit past the actual lowest point. We are on the way up. And therefore, because at present, we are in the fifth developmental stage. The fifth developmental stage. And we'll look at that. Now, we still have six and seven to go through, and we have the fifth, sixth, and seventh rounds to go through. So we have a future. Is that future assured? Yes and no. Paradox. There have been previous failures in this whole system. And this is made clear in many of the myths and legends of the ancient peoples. And I think it's reflected, isn't it, Ruth, in the Mayan myth?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And it's reflected in the Egyptian myths, in Greek myths, in Indian mythology. There have been failures. But also, there have been, it is said, some successes. And it is possible that we will make it. We have gone past the actual midpoint of the fourth of the fourth. We're now in the fifth of the fourth. And this can be shown very clearly, as we will point out, and also in discussing the whole evolutionary process. This is pointed out by the fact that by correspondence, by analogy, this relates to the principle of Manas, which is now indeed riding high. But because it's in the fourth, it is the Manasic element of Kama. And isn't this indeed where our main difficulties today are arising? But happily, there is a foreshadowing. Shall I put it in red? A foreshadowing of the sixth just coming in. Just coming in, which leads us to the beginning. And so the critical point is now, although Manas will not have its full emphasis until the fifth round. Imagine if we think Kama Manas is difficult, what Manas In other words, a double focus on manas is going to be. You see. But that will not, we really don't even begin to know, it is suggested, the full extent of what is meant by the manasic principle within us. And so our presence within this is the shifting of manas from kama manas to buddhi manas, but all within the total picture. And this is why the emphasis in so many of the spiritual texts is on the cleansing of the kamic nature, the purification of it, not killing it out, not abandoning it, but as though we are filtering out of it all the dregs that do not make it a clear, reflective principle which is utilizable, because it is to be that ultimately.
Since HPB wrote this,
mm-hmm.
have there been any changes, or is it
exactly? Oh yes, there have been, because increasingly this literal, but rather as proportions that may apply. And remember that the exoteric figures, as she calls them, she says the secret works amplify these by a division into a number of esoteric cycles never mentioned in the Brahmanical popular writings, one of which, the division of the yugas into racial cycles, is given elsewhere as an instance. And they point also that we have to keep in very much in mind today is that we know a great deal more about time, and yet we know very little about time than HPV did 100 years ago. We know, for example, we do know, for example, that time is different in different gravitational fields, so that the aging, for example, of the astronaut in going from here to the moon is different from that of his brother who remains on Earth. So we have to be a little careful on this, and I feel we have to really just take it in terms of the proportions that are indicated. And of course, in many of the ancient Brahmanical texts, the terms were used, the night of Brahma and the day of Brahma, and an age of Brahma. Now, an age was indeed seven rounds, which is generally given as this figure of 4, 3, 2, 0, followed by 6 ciphers. So that is the general figure. But when we say that number of years, are we talking about actual chronological Earth years, sidereal years? What are we talking about? I think we have to be extremely cautious in assigning our concept of years. Even our concept of a year is 365 days. We know very well that this, again, is not actual in terms of the rotation of the sun, the Earth on its orbit around the sun, don't we? And that every so often, with every fourth year, we end up with a leap year, which is then 366 days, and just recently I understand all the clocks, even the nuclear clocks, had to be set. There'd been 1/4 of a second or millisecond or something that had been dropped somewhere along the way and in order. So, one has to be extremely careful on this matter of how many years. Here is indeed where we can become so egocentric that we think that everything in the universe is measured by what I think of as a 24-hour day. And we know, even within our own system, that other planets, for example, Jupiter has what, longer days than we have, and some Mars, I think, has shorter days, and so on. I'm not all that good on my cosmogony, so my astronomy, so don't ask me too closely.
Well, we know ourselves how subjective time is.
That's right. So, as I say, I think we have to be extremely cautious in assigning years, and this is why I generally say, while I very much appreciate what Jeffrey Barborka has done, I am not at all concerned with this final chapter on chronology, because I think it can lead us astray. I think it can lead us into a blind alley and into a whole area where we just assume that everything is measured as I measure it. And we certainly know, even in measuring anything in the physical level, that you, today physics tells us you simply can't measure it. If you don't believe it, read it's the first or second chapter of Roger Jones's book, Physics as Metaphor, and you find out you can't even measure a table accurately. You see. So there are approximations, there are tolerances, and so on we have to permit.
Mm-hmm. Then the root races on each globe.
Mm-hmm.
Why have you got / each round?
Each globe in each round.
In each round.
In each round. Oh, yeah, sorry.
Mm-hmm. I have a question. Mm-hmm. There's mentioning in some of our books, I question, not say which one, that on now at this time there are still people living with consciousnesses that are on the involutionary life.
Yes.
Now, this, what does that mean?
This is, again, a very puzzling statement, but it would appear to me that while everyone on the planet at the present time is within the fifth developmental stage, the consciousness is in various substages of that great fifth developmental stage. And we also have to account for the fact, and we will when we come to reviewing the monadic evolution, the very fact that there is a kind of entry, a kind of introduction into this chain from the previous chain in a gradual process, you see. So that just as we have students entering kindergarten at the same time that we have students entering university and postgraduate level, and you can't say that the individual who is studying at postgraduate level is indeed of the same consciousness as the child entering kindergarten, or that the child entering kindergarten knows everything that the postgraduate student does. By no means is that true. So there is a gradual movement within, and we'll come to that, different classes of monads, for example, which account for, indeed, the different levels of intellectuality within this major developmental stage.
Isn't it true, just to complicate the thing a little bit more, isn't it true that in every one of us there is life on the way down and life on the way up?
Oh, yes. Yes, of course, this is true. Yeah. Our very physical bodies are composed, as we know, of innumerable lives, mm-hmm. which are seeking their own sensate experience. Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. I mean, the thing does become... I'm trying to leave out some of these little details, but it's true. It all adds to it.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, 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 the obscurations. Shirley had a very good point on this.
The difference between the obscuration and pralaya is that out of the light has left the earth, we've done all our races, it goes into obscuration because we will be coming back to the earth.
That's right.
Life doesn't leave it completely.
Yes, as it does with the chain. You see, when it goes on the chain. Now, Diana raised a point which she thought wasn't too valid, but I think it is, and I don't want anyone to be confused on it. If you look at figure one, you will see that there are seven chains in our Earth scheme. Now, I should have brought up here, you see, this is our scheme, if you like. I've called it system. Maybe that makes it easier. Now, this is typical of all of them. Typical of all of them, as you will notice on your figure one. Each one of these chains has seven globes, doesn't it? But now I am taking this one as the Earth chain, and called that because the lowest one, D, is indeed the Earth. So look at the bottom one, you see, of that, the fourth in your cycle, and you'll see Earth chain. You see that on figure one there? You see? And so,
in other words, your picture on the board is this little tiny circle on the bottom of our...
Yes, the bottom one, do you see?
You could say then that we're in the fourth round of the fourth chain.
That's right.
Of the system.
So, yes, so not only are we in the fourth round, we're on the fourth chain of this scheme, of this whole scheme, which has seven planetary chains.
Why is the moon the only other role in the
That planet? One has been definitely identified in the secret doctrine.
I see.
You see.
What are the seven globes in our Earth chain?
Now, the seven globes, one only is physical. One only is physical. Now, this has led to endless controversy, I agree. This famous Mars-Mercury controversy, which I really don't want to discuss, except to say that by analogy and by all the rules of logic and by all that HPB says repeatedly, there can be, and I think is, within our chain only one physical globe. Just as you have but one physical body. Now, there were experiments with other bodies. We can look at that also. Therefore, the next two, and I want to get into this with the other things in your diagram, are not physical, but rather are, we may say, therefore, correspond to the etheric, or the linga sharira in the technical terminology. Whereas the next two then would correspond with the comic principle, and the highest two would correspond with, are analogous to the mental principle in its lower aspect. So you will see, for example, in Barborka's work, and I think this is where sometimes confusion has come, that these are on the fourth cosmic level, the third cosmic level, the second cosmic level, the fourth, fifth, sixth, and seventh cosmic levels, I should say. And HPB also makes this clear in a statement we have somewhere here. Page 152 of Volume 1, the planetary chains composed of seven globes are graduated on the four lower planes of the world of formation, the three others belonging to the archetypal universe. So she says the four lower are planes of cosmic consciousness, the three higher planes being inaccessible to human intellect as developed at present.
And there's no names for these.
Well, yes, you can name them. Physical. If you like, I suppose the simplest is etheric. Astral. And lower mental would be the easiest. And that's indeed what you have in, I think, what you have, in just below figure 1, before figure 2, on your sheet. This is chain 4, where he calls it dense physical, above it astrophysical, and then astromental and mental. But this is the way Gardner labels it. But I think you can see how the correspondences are.
Can we assume that the other chains in the scheme were centered in the solar system?
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. Within our, that's what it seems to be implied in the literature. Yes, Harold.
When we've gone through the 6th and 7th root races,
mm-hmm,
on globe D,
mm-hmm,
then we go on to globe E.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's right. And we have 7.
What kind of people are we then?
We will not have dense physical bodies.
Do we take the animals and everything out of the world?
The entire life wave moves on and is in its an etheric condition, but a higher etheric condition than it was on C. One sub-level up, it is said.
Yeah, the relationship to the fourth round and the fourth during the fourth half,
mm-hmm,
plus in relation to consciousness, if we are in the fifth, do I understand?
Yes, 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 yes. Wouldn't you agree? Yes, wouldn't you agree, Bill?
Yes.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. Now,
can I ask you again, mm-hmm, first, Billy? Each of those cosmic planes have their own 7 subplanes.
That's right.
And each of those 7 subplanes are labeled mental, astral,
that's right,
and physical.
And this is this is very clearly brought out in the esoteric writings of HPB, which is of course volume 5 of the Adyar edition, and is found in volume 12 of the collected writings. But I find it very useful to simply get this quest book, the esoteric writings of H.P. Blavatsky, which is the totality of volume 5 of the Adyar edition. And it's a nice paperback and easily handled and so on. And on pages 432 to 435, H.P.B. gives a number of diagrams. And she took, for example, she then took the lowest plane of Prakriti, or the true terrestrial. It's rather interesting. The authentic, in other words, now, just to complicate you further, I might just as well get you out of here. This also ties in with the tattvas and with the lokas. So one has to eventually study all of these in their relationship, you see. In the tattvas, the Prakriti is indeed the densest, and it is what we're dealing with. And so she says, the true terrestrial plane, or 7th cosmic plane, she divides it, para-ego or atmic, inner ego or buddhic, ego-manas, Kama manas or lower manas, pranic kama or psychic, astral. Remember that in her day the word astral was what we have now translated generally as etheric. We have to remember that. So she called it astral. And then objective. And she said, evidently, that its objective or sensuous plane is that which is sensed by the 5 physical senses. Now, because she says that the senses develop pari passu with the root races, and everybody on the globe today has 5 physical senses, although some not developed as much as others, this is why we can say that we are the atmosphere, the climate of consciousness is within the 5th developmental period. But that doesn't mean that everybody has reached that. Do you see? There's a difference. Yes, John.
Well, can I bring in the word Laya Center here? In other words, the earth has a Laya Center.
The Laya Center, yes. Say Laya Center.
And you know, the physical earth, which we see.
Yes.
Yes. But then the center of all that is the Laya Center.
That's right.
So like the seventh.
That's right. And this we'll see in a moment, if I get to it today. This indeed is true at between every division. There is what is known as a Laya center. That is where everything becomes homogeneous. That is a kind of viscous mass, if you like. Laya is from Li, to dissolve. So it is neither this nor that. And as it reforms, if you like, you can use again as an analogy the process of the caterpillar becoming a butterfly. In the cocoon stage, that is a Laya point. It's a viscous mass.
Yeah.
It is neither caterpillar nor butterfly at that stage, is it? If you were to slice open, don't do it because that's cruelty. Mm-hmm. But if you were to slice open, or you were to look with an X-ray, maybe that's better, at the inside of the cocoon, there is a state where you would not recognize anything in there. It would be non-differentiated. All of the organs and being of the caterpillar are sort of in a viscous emulsion. And that, in a sense, is comparable to a Laya center. It is not yet the butterfly, but as it reforms, it becomes the butterfly and breaks the cocoon and flies and so on, do you see?
Mm-hmm.
So there is a point between, let us say, the objective and what she calls the astral or the etheric. And she says, on the second plane, things are reversed. And of course, this is why she very frequently saw, in looking clairvoyantly, as she called it, in the astral light, at books that, you know, and she would reverse the number on the page. Instead of seeing it as 723, she'd see it as 327. You see, because it's reversal. It's a reversal. Of the
like a mirror
image. Its third plane is psychic. Here is the instinct which prevents a kitten going into the water and getting drowned. And then she gives the following table of the terrestrial objective consciousness. Terrestrial, so that even within the objective, or within these true terrestrial plane, the objective consciousness is first sensuous, second instinctual, third physiological emotional, fourth passional emotional, fifth mental emotional, sixth spiritual emotional, seven X. The unknown.
Well, that was my question. Does the butterfly take the last center with it?
Well,
what happens? It's just the last center?
It's just, you see, there is a point which is dimensionless.
That's what I'm saying.
Yes, okay. Yes, that's right.
It's like the yolk and the egg.
Yes. That's right. Yes, that's very true. Yeah.
If the Laya center, which is non-differentiated, can it be compared to the void or the plenum in the void or something like that?
Well, it can in a way. Now, when we used this term obscuration, it referred to the globe. The period in between, somebody asked about what consciousness was like. Presumably, it was in a Maya condition. You see, mm-hmm. To be technical about it, until it is reawakened and so reformed in a sense, because these are levels of form. They may not be form to our objective vision, but they are rupa levels. Now, that's very difficult for us to to really understand. But they are rupa levels. Well, I want to just, because I've given you these two pages, point out, we may not get through it. It's all right. We can take it up next time, because I want to go slowly enough that I hope this is beginning to have meaning for you and make sense. Now, the one of the things that we have to see is that there is a kind of progressive change, so that this is a key point. In the planetary chain, for example, it's analogous to a human body's growth from infancy to maturity. You can't, you see, while generally the picture has been given to us of these separate globes, it's like taking your own, you know, taking a succession of pictures of yourself. Here I am at birth, you know, that you have a picture of yourself at birth, and then a picture of yourself, say, at age 7, and a picture of yourself at age 14, and a picture of yourself at age 21. And you show these to somebody, you see, and you say, and the person says, oh, that, 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 and doesn't see that in between you have gone through a gradual development, haven't you? Which you know, you see. But the person, let's say somebody appears from Mars, and he looks at this succession of pictures, and he says, what sudden changes? At 7, you don't look at all like you did at birth. And you say, well, it wasn't that sudden. I had 6 years in between. Don't you? Do you see? So we have to see this. So this diagram can never depict more than a momentary phase in the growth. But more information, of course, was given to us in some of the later works. But the important thing that we have to realize is, first of all, this whole chain is, in a sense, a reincarnation of the preceding chains of our scheme of planets, and especially of its immediate predecessor, the moon chain. Hence, within the all-inclusive magnetic field from the beginning, the subtle globes of the moon chain, with their unabsorbed planetary skandhas, if you like, you may remember my wonderful mystic saying last night at the lodge, which I gave you all for meditation. He who sits on his skandhas will know several nirvanas. Now, there are just as from life to life, there are unfulfilled skandhas, that is, bundles of attributes, which we then carry into a new incarnation. So this whole planetary chain has or represents the rebirth of the unabsorbed skandhas or bundles of attributes of our seed vortices, technically called sishtas, if you like, are, in our other words, now re-embodied and successively awakened into activity. Now, the easiest way to picture this is what is the way in which we have in figure 2. It is said, in other words, that the growth comes about by a process which is analogous to division, cellular division. Now, that's an interesting point, again, by analogy, that it really, as the globes become, as the chain becomes denser, the globes develop in sequence, but all arise from a common center. So there is, if you like, John, coming back to your Laya center, a Mahalaya center. Mm-hmm. From the period of the interplanetary pralaya, you see, from the moon chain, then a center which now gives birth to successive globes, so that it arises from a common center, though not all, as they emerge, are of the same substance. Now, in the first set of stanzas, stanza 6 in volume 1, page 207 and 208, describes this. First, one manifested, six concealed. Two manifested, five concealed. Three manifested, four concealed. Lastly, seven small wheels revolving, one giving birth to the other. It's marvelous. So this is a succession that takes place. And in these divisions or fissions, new births, the vital stimulating principle is supplied from the corresponding globe of the previous chain. Now that adds some complication here, if you like. So from globe A of the moon chain, there is a transferal of the skandhas, as it were, of that. Globe B of the moon chain, and meanwhile this has given birth to that, you see, but awakened then the skandhas or attributes unrealized in globe B. And so there is always this. And so from the moon to the earth has come a transfer. Now this is pictured very clearly by Barborka, which I haven't given you because this book is in print, isn't it? Peopling of the Earth is available. And Barborka has a marvelous picture of this on page 122 of the Peopling of the Earth. So, it is, in other words, the mental field or globe A, the first to manifest, is based then on the web of the universe, if you like, shared by all the chains of our solar system. It fills the entire field of the projected chain and has the ring pass knot of the chain for its periphery. It's the foundation. A becomes, in a sense, the foundation for all the others that will emerge, even though they're pictured of the same size. The astral field, globe B, is at first composed of two planes only, then, astral and mental, but later becomes closely involved with denser levels. And the subtle physical globe is at first interwoven with the three fields, mental, astral, and etheric, and acts then, this acts as the interior matrix for globe D to emerge. You see. So, perhaps we can begin to see that there is a gradual emergence, and it's always an emergence from within outwards, from a center, a lie of center, if you like, outwards into densification.
The universe is always there, right?
Well, the point I wanted to get at, you see, is the interrelationship, really, of the seven globes of our chain. As HBB points out, and in, she quotes in this a letter from the Master, volume 1, page 225 of The Secret Doctrine, the globes which overshadow our earth are in coadjunition but not in consubstantiality with our earth. Now that is the central point. Coadjunition, of course, is a botanical term for branchings from the same point on a shrub or tree, such as a number of leaves. And the allusions that have been given to us, for example, in the Mahatma letters to ellipses and the epicycloid form, wheels within wheels, gives us a picture of related pairs of globes as they exist in successive chains of a scheme. So it would appear that the group of seven planets composing our chain branch from a common point, are closely related, and are assembled successively. Or, as the phrase in the stanzas, one giving birth to the other. And consequently, this may be suggested is similar to cell division, which is there in figure 2. And those familiar with the processes of propagation by fission will appreciate the relevance of this concept. Separation of the nucleus into two parts heralds the inception of cell division. As the spheres separate and the two separate nuclei assume control, the result is a double cell, which may continue to be joined or may separate completely. So it would seem, from the comments and parallels presented, that the sequential appearance of the globes of a chain may be presumed to occur very much as a cell divides. The one planet in the first chain, for example, dividing like a cell, the two resulting in mental globes would remain attached, as in figure 2. And the overlapping of the two, would then compose what we can call a generative center, and which in the ancient texts has been called the vesica piscis, for the conception and birth of a third planet, as in figure 3. And so we have this marvelous suggestion, which is on page 2 of the symbolic presentation of the chain, and particular figure 5, the seven globes of our planetary chain, and this is the way I much prefer to see them, with a common center in coadjunition. Now you have to, in this, add, as though through it, C and E are in front of and behind D, as the little paragraph under that indicates. In other words, C and E are not there because it takes a three-dimensional. They are in coadjunition, which means they are branches, interlinked, but not consubstantiation, which means they are not of the same substance. Not in consubstantiation. So that this prakritik plane is not of the same substance as the a pranic or kamic plane, but that can be in coadjunition because it interpenetrates it, doesn't it?
Could you just give us a reference for that?
Yes, that particular reference is Secret Doctrine, Volume 1, page 225. The globes which overshadow our Earth are in coadjunition, but not in consubstantiality. So while we picture them this way, that is not really the way they are. They are all here. And therefore, we can pass from one globe to another without going anywhere.
That's a matter of consciousness.
It all is a matter of consciousness. That is why then we have to understand that, and that's why I want to look at these stages of consciousness, which by analogy, remember, by analogy, the seven stages of consciousness within the fourth realm, by analogy, are experienced as the developmental stages through the whole cycle. You see why I've separated them, the life wave and the consciousness, from now trying to get you the structure. And why I have been resisting the other. Because all we can look at is what we know, I mean, what's been given to us, really, which are the seven stages within this particular realm. But by analogy, we may infer that that is what happened in the whole cycle. Well.
Thank you.